quid and spout.
Yeah.
And so again, here with Dawn, we're actually now at the top of Epping Forest Open Space, which is a view from the pole here, the Chingford Meridian Pole, which has a plaque to the memory of T.E. Lawrence, who lived in the woods up here for a short period after coming back from the war. And you look down into the city from here. But we stood here as Inspire London with groups on a couple of occasions, once in the winter, once more in the spring, I think we walked through here. And I was just going to ask Dawn about Sound Camp as an idea, as a project, and how you create a community from that idea or initial idea, concept.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing about Sound Camp, I suppose, is it's like a network of lots of independent communities who sort of come together, you know, that one weekend a year to listen to each other's live streams. So, I guess we just sort of feel our way around it in a lot of ways. You can put calls out here, there and everywhere, but I think the most sort of, successful way, if you want to call it that, is just really sort of going off people who we know and think that they might, you know, they have some contact with an interesting space that they want to spend time in, and then sort of community usually sort of forms around that, really, and then they might know someone else who has another place that they sort of get some people together. So yeah, it can be quite organic, really. It always works best, I think, when it comes from that sort of combination of people who've been interested in a particular spot and also having something, an interest to share, whether that's music or whether it's birds or fish or I don't know, whatever it is. And then they'll sort of come round, and they tend to be the most regular ones as well, because, you know, sometimes people dip in for a year and they find it quite challenging for one reason or another. Maybe it's to get access to the space, or so it's really important that people are sort of free to access a spot as well as having the enthusiasm to go there and listen. Because
I mean, one of the things that's sort of remarkable about Sound Camp, though, is the perseverance of it, and that it's building up over the years. That it started with, you know, essentially State Hill Ecology Park as the main Sound Camp, but now it happens all around the world. And how that's happened, and how you sort of build that into a kind of international community in a way.
But I mean, again, I think it's just because what people are doing in general. You know, if you're doing music, then you're travelling around, you meet people in different places, and same as if you're sort of, you know, researching anything or interested in reading, I mean, you know, you'll pick up on different networks that way. So it really just sort of evolved from people who are maybe interested in radio or field recording. I mean, they're the core groups, really. And sort of experimental sound. And then, of course, you get people who are sort of doing more fine art practice with walking or something as well. They can be sort of quite reliable groups. But, the core of it, I think, is the people who are sort of out there doing stuff, making radio programs or releasing albums or, that kind of activity, really.
So, I mean, it is quite specific, though, isn't it, Sound Camp, in terms of what I was sort of getting at, is the fact that someone might have a microphone or be involved with looking after a microphone long term in space, which then gets mapped and
Because there are different levels of engagement, I guess. Like, some places it takes quite a lot of engineering to set up a mic in, like, you know, South Walney, for example. I mean, we were up in Cumbria, we were lucky there because Octopus are very you know, active. They have a lot of resources, and they also had a connection with Sarah, the wildlife trust person, and she was very happy for them to go up there and set the mic. Fortunately, this remote coastal spit had some kind of lamppost on it where she could take the power from. So, I mean, a lot of it is just sort of pure luck. You know, there's no way you would sort of plan to run a power cable all the way out there. And the same with Stave Hill, actually. You know, this is, if it wasn't for Rebecca, I doubt people would be coming back year on year. You know, it's because of her enthusiasm for the project, and, you know, she's really happy for people to to be there. And so you need that as well. You know, you need the community stakeholder, the sort of environment stakeholders to be up for it, because otherwise, you know, it's just too much of a sort of battle. Although it doesn't have to be sort of a lot of people all the time, because I came at it from sort of just going out individually and streaming from the Bivvy broadcast, which, yes, I had the support of Forestry Commission, which was great, because normally they don't let you randomly roam around in those kind of places and sleep. But for this project, I had access, so that was quite a unique thing. And, you know, occasionally people go off into the desert or do something more individually, or maybe just a couple of people. And they're often, like, really interesting streams to listen to, you know, because the more inaccessible they are by foot, the more sort of unusual they normally are, you know, to listen to. So, yeah, it's all sorts of activities, really. Key point is they're shared through this kind of, like, transmission and reception thing. You know, we hope that the people who send out the streams are also listening.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And so, I believe, are you doing something with the Waltham Forest, the projects that are going on with that?
Yeah, there's an ambition to do that. It's so, but I want to keep the location kind of secret for that. And it's also, you know, working with an invited group on this occasion, just because, you know, trying to manage people sleeping out in cities is a little bit different to, well, anywhere, actually. It's always a bit of a challenge, like, turning up with a bunch of people trying to sleep out. It's kind of a bit more radical than you think, you know, especially if it's not a sort of designated campsite or something, you know, just a random patch of land. It's actually quite difficult to get permission to do that kind of thing. If you...
No, well, I mean, you, this year you had Platform came to share their project that they did originally with the camping around the city.
Yeah, 89, I think, wasn't it? So, no, I really love that project. And again, it was one of those things, I was kind of just looking for artists who'd work with tents. And they had, fortunately at the time, it's gone now, but they had an entry at the website, you know, of past projects, which has since vanished. And it was like, wow, this is really amazing. You know, and at that time in London as well, for me, it's before I got here, a good sort of, like, you know, maybe, what, 20 years or something before I came here. So, it, for that reason, I was kind of curious how much London had changed, you know, between then and now. And also, I was just really impressed with what they were doing. I mean, they had conversations with experts. I mean, the Herbert Girardet, who came to talk at Soundcamp, he's real sort of, you know, urban ecology professional, travels around the world helping people live in, with more sort of green energy involved, and think about, you know, just the idea that nature's not something out there. You know, we need to sort of nurture it in the city, or we're screwed big time.
I was fascinated by that he was part of a group set up when Ken Livingstone was the mayor of London, and they started, and that's how Stave Hill started, really. It was the original sort of ecologist, the first ecologist for the city was appointed then. And
yeah, true, the Trust for Urban Ecology. So I mean, that whole time period I thought was really interesting, to ask them to come back to talk about what was going on in London then. And then they had this amazing film too, which they put on YouTube afterwards, of the sort of, you know, the two artists, John and James, sort of wandering around the rubble in the Docklands just as Canary Wharf was being built. And it really is like another world looking at them then. You know, they're saying it's a shame how that whole history was being erased, and the sort of way everything was being planned now. And then, of course, you've got it again with all the developments happening around Canada Water, and people up in arms about how the whole nature of the neighbourhood is going to be changed, and also the pressure on Stave Hill with more and more people
very much so.
Sort of coming through. So anyway, but I think sort of Platform as a group are just really, we're really happy to have them involved, and hopefully they'll come back again next year, you know, maybe contribute again. That would be great. Yeah, because they've got the Secret Rivers thing as well.
They were involved with sort of revealing all the lost rivers of London as projects in the 80s.
Yeah.
So they've got a very rich history. But what struck me, though, was the sort of the actual mental strain on their health, which they talked about, which was mainly to do with the noise of the traffic, where some of the places they camped. Obviously not Stave Hill so much, but they're at Vauxhall Cross at one.
Yeah, next to major motorways and things like that. I think that was also quite interesting for me. So two things, I guess, the whole process of the time spent outside. It's like, you know, if you stick your head out, you walk along the motorway for 5 minutes, yeah, it's not very nice, but you don't really come away being that affected. But if you sort of camped there, you know, listening to these comings and goings and major infrastructures of the city, like, you know, they talk about the, was it the Stave around Rotherhithe somewhere being the bomb hole of the city or something like that, I don't know. But very conscious of these sort of movements of, like, energy and waste and...
Well, Rotherhithe was considered that. Bermondsey was always considered part in the city's history as the place that the sort of the swamp side of the river.
Yeah, yeah.
For the waste.
Yeah.
But obviously it wasn't for people who lived there.
Yeah, I guess they talk about the metabolism as well, like having this sense of the city being a living thing that needs feeding, and also its waste is going to go somewhere. And that's why, yeah, I think also this idea of a city without limits, because especially if you track all the things coming in from the other side of the world and then where they disappear to as well. So I guess it's the time spent outside sort of opens your senses a little bit to these sort of rhythms that otherwise you sort of deliberately shut yourself off to just to get by. You know, the sort of scale of the movements of things coming in and out is sort of...
Yeah, I was struck by them talking about that, the noise of the city and that being equated to what was going on in terms of movements of you know, literally materials coming in to yes, as he said, feed the insatiable appetite of the city.
Yeah.
And obviously, where Stave Hill is, it was one of those places where it was a kind of entry into the city of all this raw material from around the world when London was the centre of this empire. How it's like stripping everything away, and how that still is going on.
And then Matt Parker, I don't know if you caught his stuff as well, he came along sort of talking about the hidden sort of energy networks, you know, going into sort of power the internet and things like that, and the sort of the cost of running servers and things like that, which, it, you know, at SoundCamp, I think Maria was particularly kind of
affected
shocked
by that.
It's like wondering, well, just the realisation that we're part of this web, and yeah, we might be sort of like very conscious of tuning people into, you know, their natural environment, and but at the same time we're contributing, you know, through sort of putting stuff on the web and working on that platform. You know, we're in the mix, we're definitely part of the problem.
Very small. I mean, it's very difficult not to be implicated, but just you mentioned Maria there, and she, sadly she couldn't come today because she's ill, but could you say something about Maria's particular contribution, or because I know that you do, a couple of years you had some stuff from Greece and some of the Athens based stuff. Maybe you could mention that.
Yeah, well, Maria, I mean, she does all sorts of, she teaches down in Brighton, and she has her own sort of practice in music as well as the sort of more sound arty type radio art vein of things. And she really helped put the network for Reveille, the broadcast, together, like make us the main partners, Wave Farm. You know, she'd been there on a residency and had a lot of contacts really through her presenting and performing and work around. So that really helped sort of forge those key parts of Reveille early on. And also she has just, you know, a particular sensitivity, you know, like we all do, but she, especially related to that sort of walking broadcasting practice that she does, it's like sort of weaving her own sort of responses in a live way, you know, into this kind of broadcast. Which is quite interesting, which often opens or closes Reveille. So, it's a shame she can't be here, but perhaps she'll be contributing.
Well, hopefully she'll
ways,
come. Yeah. We'll be able to go on a little walk with her where she could do some of that kind of way of working and share that, because that's, I mean, in a way that happens with our community in Iswara, London, we have a lot of conversations as we're walking along the trail, and which are opened up by the things that appear. You know, there's a lot of things that you're not expecting, but also you're sometimes quite in a tunnel because you're having this conversation. So there's something interesting there about, I mean, it's a big part of walking, art practice, and conversations and dialogue. But I think it is a very particular thing if you listen to someone, yeah, broadcasting live when they're going through space, the actual physical space becoming as much part of the broadcast as the voices and those sounds.
And the movement as well changes everything, changes the perspective, like as you listen, especially with the binaural mics that she uses, you get that sense of sort of changing direction. But yeah, I think it's a, sort of a nice counterpoint to the more stable streams, because, you know, there you really are rooted, you're sort of relying on things sort of moving by, which is nice, but it's, yeah, it's like the difference between going on a walk or sitting in a bird hide, that kind of thing. Yeah, very. Yeah, maybe one is more suited to long-term, you know, engagement with one particular spot, whereas the other one is more fluid, I guess.
More about, place in a way, which is a fluid thing, really.
Like, more about how we experience place, anyway.
Very much so. Brilliant. Thank you.
Right.